It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. People are doing it at home, at work, and at school, in the bathroom, in the park, at farms, and even funerals. They're taking selfies, snapshots of themselves to post online. And this has become such a cultural phenomenon, the Oxford Dictionary's named selfie their word of the year for 2013. Now, there may be as many opinions about selfies as there are Twitter handles. Are selfies empowerment, narcissism, personal branding, art? If you're like me, you know what a selfie is, but do you really get it? Writer and critic Sarah Nicole Prickett came in to give us a primer. Steve Paulson talked with her.
Well, thank you so much for coming to the studio, and everything sounds fine, and we can go ahead and start then.
Great. How do I look?
Sarah, we asked you to come into the studio to guide us through the selfie phenomenon, particularly those of us who are not in our teens or 20s. And I have to be honest here, I don't look at that many selfies myself, but I know they are ubiquitous for a lot of people. How are people using them?
Well, first of all, we're defining selfie as a picture that you take of your own face, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if many of the people who are making selfies are really trying to categorize it in the way that the media does. For instance, oh, selfies are feminist selfies, or they're tools for empowerment. But I think for most of the people who are taking selfies, you're portraying yourself the way that you want to be seen, the way you hope others see you.
For a lot of people who are older, I mean, I think the whole idea of posting a casual photo of myself for the whole world to see seems kind of odd, frankly.
Have you ever put a picture of a baby on Facebook?
Yes.
Well, babies are a lot less interesting than grown humans, at least to my way of thinking. They all kind of look the same. Or a picture of a dog or a cat, a picture of a new piece of furniture. All of these are aspects of yourself that you can display. They form a composite that you hope will be recognizable as your personality. I don't see a face as being any odder a choice than your baby or your dog.
That's interesting. So there's nothing about that self-portrait that is, I don't know, giving away more than it would be to take a picture of your dinner table or your baby.
It depends, of course. The selfie is such a multifarious thing. There are selfies that are meant to convey expression or mood. There are selfies that are meant to convey beauty, an ideal of yourself. Those are the ones most commonly attributed to women, especially young women, and especially young female narcissists, as much of the media would have it.
Well, let me follow up on that. There is research that suggests that girls do, in fact, post selfies more often than boys do. Why do you think that is?
There's probably a higher demand for it. That may be a cynical answer, but I think teen girls feel constantly looked at and judged. There was an article posted on Jezebel some time ago by a writer who posited that selfies were a cry for help. And of course, this cry for help was met with an outcry for her head. And many women, particularly women of color, were saying this selfie is feminist because you don't recognize my beauty, but I do.
So this whole narrative that we've been hearing a lot about the last couple of years, that there's something narcissistic about selfies, that just doesn't hold water for you.
Not really. And it's tinged with moral panic. There's a great deal of power to be had in deciding what is beautiful. And for a long time, that power was concentrated in the hands of male artists. But we're seeing women now able to say for themselves, this is what I think is beautiful. This is how I think I look beautiful. And of course, we can never totally divorce what I think is beautiful from what everybody else thinks is beautiful. But it's cool that you can search the selfie tag on Instagram or on Tumblr and you can see a huge variety of faces, many more kinds of faces and also bodies than you see in even the new, like, unretouched Abercrombie ads. Dove, Abercrombie, all these companies want to show real girls, real women, but they're still not doing as good a job as the selfie tag is.
Now, it seems that another way to look at this whole phenomenon is, you know, this is just part of the new landscape that we swim in now with social media and smartphones, and, you know, maybe it's just another form of communication.
Yeah, I think it is a form of communication sometimes. I think it's a way of saying hi. And if you just want to say, I like the way I look today, it seems so completely harmless. I've thought about it a lot. I mean, since you asked me to be on the show, I've thought about what harm the selfie could possibly do. I think the only thing for me is sometimes maybe if you're taking them when you're very young and you're putting it on the internet, maybe you're not aware that it will stay on the internet. And there's some faces you don't want to be stuck with, you know. I just don't feel that I have to defend my right, my whim, my will, or whatever, to take a picture of my face. It seems to be those who never post a selfie who are most concerned with what it all means. I would say try it and then have an idea about it.
Sarah Nicole Prickett is a contributing editor at The New Inquiry and editor of Adult Magazine. And lately, the press has been pumping out opinion pieces about selfies. And one of the biggest debates is, what do they say about self-esteem? So we turn to the psychologists.
So I'm Paula Niedenthal, professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin at Madison.
My name is Yoey Tibbetts. I'm a third-year graduate student in the social psychology department. Oh, and I'm 26 years old.
I'm Adrienne Wood. I'm also a graduate student in the social psychology department. I'm 24 years old, and I'm a second year in the program.
Paula, Yoey, and Adrienne just finished a graduate seminar on identity and self-concept.
I started asking my friends what they thought of selfies. I don't take a ton of selfies myself. Interestingly enough, I don't know if there is one popular opinion about selfies. I think some people seem to think it's very good for self-esteem, and then others have more of a negative view on the whole phenomenon of selfies. But one thing I can say is that people had very strong opinions on both sides. And I wondered how that was related to the self-esteem of the people I was actually talking to. Like maybe people with high self-esteem who post selfies all the time, you know, think it's a great idea and it's an awesome way to seek that consistency and positive feedback that they want from the world.
Yeah, I've never been a big selfie person. I have kind of a minimal presence on social media. I do have Facebook and everything. So I had kind of a negative view of people who post a lot of selfies. My kind of negative view of selfies came from watching people actually do it and how it interrupted the activities they were doing. Like we would be at a party or we'd be traveling or whatever, and everything would stop so that we could all turn to face our smartphone and take the picture and then like put the right filter on it. And it just kind of seems like an event didn't really happen, like a party didn't really happen, or you didn't really go on that trip until it has been posted on Facebook or on Instagram.
It was my impression that from what we read, popular culture articles, that it was viewed as this new and narcissistic and semi-dramatic phenomenon that we have to worry about. And there's been portraiture photography and portraiture painting forever. This is a really old thing. People represent the self. They control the representation of what they look like, whether they like how it looks.
I tried to go back even further before self-portraits and was thinking, what's the first shred of evidence that we wanted to preserve some sense of the self? And I went all the way back to like the Neanderthals, like 40,000 years ago, putting handprints on the caves. It was almost as if they were saying, like, I'm here, I exist.
One of the perspectives in the self-concept literature is the idea that we understand ourself as we imagine others perceive it. And throughout your life, you're getting feedback from people. But at some point, you shift so that you can also imagine how others are perceiving you, and you internalize that, and that becomes your representation of what yourself is. So if you think others perceive you as beautiful and smart, then that's part of your self-concept. So this is a very literal application of that, where people imagine that someone's going to look at this picture and like it, and then they actually will like it. So it's, we're no longer imagining what people think about ourselves. We're actually getting that feedback when people comment on the picture or like it.
So people are always looking to others to figure out who they are. Do people think I'm attractive? Am I attractive? And if you liked that photograph, or if you're telling me I'm attractive, then maybe I'm going to start to feel attractive. Putting those things out there and finding out people like it and how they respond to it seems to be really important in the construction of identity.
My inkling is that there will be a generation of people who can no longer imagine how others perceive them, or even just think about how they perceive themselves and use that. I worry that there's going to be a generation, my generation, where we actually require others' explicit approval or disapproval to know where we stand in the world.
And I'll probably take the slightly less like scared and dire view and think that this is co-evolving with the availability of more choices and more things to do in the world, who you could possibly become, which behaviors you could possibly engage in. Now we have a lot of options. So in fact, it could be that we are outsourcing our development of our self-concept, but we probably need quite a lot of help these days since the choices are so numerous, and we do need actually a lot of feedback about who we are, whether we're taking the right route.
That's a really interesting question, because the self-concept is changing and adjusting oftentimes to the context in which you're operating or being evaluated in. I'm very interested to see what it does for your sense of self. Do you become more complex as a person, given that you have all these opportunities to engage in different scenarios and different events?
But is there really so much room for the self to be as fluid as it typically has been conceived as? Like, if everything is recorded, all of these developmental processes of exploring different selves, if that all of that is recorded on the internet in some way, people can go back and find all the moments at which your past selves were contradicting your current self. So in some ways, it could almost force you to become more ingrained and like if it's recorded really early.
Sort of solidify something or creates a picture of you. Well, one of the motivations we were talking about earlier actually is the fact that it allows the selves to be more visible to more people in a way that is actually positive. So many high school students think that nobody knows who they really are, or nobody knows their hidden talents. And for the first time, it's a kind of a great leveler. You know, it's not just the king of wherever who has the portrait of himself. Now you have the shy person who's actually a good actress, or the not very popular person who's an excellent artist, who's going to do the selfie at the Art Institute or with getting some award or something and say, that's actually who I am. I mean, I know that you don't know who I am, but that's who I am. And so there's a positive public display of the complexity of the self. You know, a selfie is not a selfie is not a selfie. There seem to be so many different kinds with so many, serving so many functions for identity and the self-concept.
Yeah, I think we can't forget that humans are incredibly social animals, and we need to feel recognized, and we need others to acknowledge our existence. And I think that so many human behaviors, like from the beginning of human existence, have been reflective of that, whether it's self-portraits or autobiographies or art. Everything is just to try to have other people say, yes, you exist, mm-hmm. and like have that somehow be acknowledged.
Yeah, it's almost like a communicative nature behind it. Like, I'm putting this out there to tell everyone I exist. I'm here. This is me. I don't think I've ever taken a selfie and put it up on social media, but I have taken selfies on like Snapchat and sent them to friends as a way of communicating like how I'm feeling or what I'm doing. They sent me this awesome picture. I'm a Boston Red Sox fan. So they sent me a picture of like David Ortiz hitting a home run, and I just, a picture of me with a beer like, yay, you know, and that's purely communicative. That's me saying that's awesome. I'm so happy that you're doing that, and I wish I was there. And
it shows so much.
Yeah, your emotional reaction to something. Yeah, tweet can show. And I wonder if constantly seeing yourself from a third person perspective in all these photos online can kind of give you a sense of perspective that we don't normally have, and maybe allow you to see yourself the way you might view a friend and see, oh yeah, like when I
should be nicer to myself.
Yeah, I should be nicer to myself, because like in general, I am a really cool, like nice looking person.
Adrienne Wood and Yoey Tibbetts are graduate students in the University of Wisconsin's Psychology Department, where Paula Niedenthal is a professor. Somewhere in a small studio in Brooklyn, there's an artist who's reimagining selfies. Aaron Riley finds online self-portraits, usually of women and usually half-dressed, and she transforms them into larger-than-life tapestries. Her woven women don't have faces, but they do have stories.
So I was working on a series, and I started researching and sort of culling the internet of images of young women, the selfie kind of pictures, cell phone sexting images. The first selfie I wove was this girl, a series of her pictures. She had taken them all for her boyfriend, and then she posted them on her blog. So they were repetitive images of her in her underwear or naked. And when I've taken selfies or pictures to send to people, they resemble these. And then I work with that image. I just trace it out using pen on a transparency paper and trace that to scale so that an 8.5 by 11 image turns into something that's 4 feet wide by, you know, 5 feet tall or 3 feet tall. So the way weaving works is it's from the very bottom up, about an inch an hour. So 25 to 30 hours of just weaving on a piece like that. Working on a tapestry of a young girl or of a woman in her underwear or in front of the mirror, you do kind of lose the fact that this is salacious. And I have kind of become desensitized to the shock factor of my pieces. I definitely was taught as a child to be a modest woman, to not flaunt your sexuality. So I went into this project kind of seeing these women as putting themselves at harm. The subject matter is emotional. I have an image of the girl in front of me, and I am sort of connecting to her as I work. So, I mean, I grew up kind of like a loner kid, and I always studied our yearbooks and kind of had these make-believe friendships with my peers or, you know, upperclassmen through yearbooks. And so I've developed this way to kind of connect to strangers through images, and it has allowed me to become obsessed with a scenario that I don't know the details around, and I kind of make the details up and add my own narrative to how she's feeling and how whoever she sent it to responds. The idea that you can take an image that you've spent a while taking and send it and it's not well received, or they just kind of ask for more. So I can kind of relate to the fact that images are rarely given the time that's deserved. I think as I grow older and sort of become more of a confident woman, I judge the girls in the images less. The reactions to my work varies from frat guy like yay for boobies and college girls saying, you've captured my life so clearly, to people coming to me asking for my opinion on how they should talk to their kids about these things, why this is so prevalent. I had started to get a lot of backlash with the nudity in my work, and people were saying that I was just furthering exploitation of women. And I, throughout the entire process, was thinking of these girls as myself, really relating to the lifestyle of sexting or internet chatting or emailing images to boyfriends. So I started using my own images because I wanted to sort of tell the world that I was one of them. I wasn't judging them. When I first made a tapestry of myself, I was working on a really large scale, so I was weaving all of these details. I was weaving all of my tattoos and coming upon these parts of my body that I had studied for so long, you know, my thighs, my breasts, and I was living in my studio, so I was waking up looking at these images, showering every day, you know, seeing my body in real life, but also weaving my body. So I became really comfortable. Revealing that image, part of me was uncomfortable and nervous, but it was really, like, empowering to show these images and to work with them.
You can find links to Erin Riley's tapestries on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, Steve Rogenbuck talks about why he included selfies in his latest book of poems. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Today we're talking about selfies, those pictures people take of themselves and post online. So sitting down to interview a poet,
someone who's all about words, might not seem like an obvious choice. But Steve Rogenbuck is not a traditional poet. I mean, sure, he writes, but he's built a following by posting videos of himself to YouTube. When producer Sarah Nix talked with Rogenbuck, they started out by listening to one of those videos.
This is a poem I wrote for my girlfriend called "What is Heavy Petting and Can We Please Do It?" If you ever perform a Lutheran or Methodist sex act on me, I will simply tell you, "Darling, this is not satanic like you promised." And you will probably reply, "YOLO." And then for your birthday, I will get you elected as a legislator in the House of Representatives, which will really piss you off. I really want a British man to narrate a video about our mating rituals. Like the moment when we start watching Kazam is when the movie would start. You look so good in a mirror holding a phone. I want you in the place where you swallow rain. I want you in the quietness of these animals and their homes. When I'm doing anything with you, I think I want to do this with you until the end of the year of the horse. You are more beautiful than a horse. Every comparison between a non-human animal and you seems accurate. You seem like you are a toy bird full of live birds. You seem like rain passing through lower clouds. You seem like in the universe there is nothing softer than you. I like you so much, I view your snaps for the whole 10 seconds. With you, the silence of the moon is not like usual silence. It is more.
When did you start posting YouTube videos?
I started that around the beginning of 2011. Basically, I was interested in looking at the internet and seeing all these different forms that language can take. And so I was working on image macros, kind of like the lolcats where you put words over a picture. I was interested in using Twitter and Facebook status updates as language. But yeah, the videos have been what has taken off the most.
So do you consider the videos poems?
That is a very interesting question. I consider them poetry. I think you can definitely understand them as poems, but it takes a sort of an open mind.
A lot of your videos have tens of thousands of views. And I imagine that for a lot of emerging poets, they'd be very happy to know that one of their poems had been read even 30,000 times or more. Beside the view count, what kind of responses do you get to the videos?
Well, the best thing I get is just individual messages from people telling me that my videos have had such an important impact in their lives. A common thing that people say is that they watch some video of mine every morning when they wake up or something. In the same way as almost like meditation to sort of put them in the right state of mind to recenter themselves on who they want to be, that my videos can actually be doing that for people is really encouraging to me.
I wonder if one of the videos that people watch a lot is "We're Alive at the Same Time." Maybe we should play that one. Actually, I should mention that it's called "We're Alive at the Same Time, ; which is the smiley face emoticon.
I caught my wife appearing offline to me. I knew from that day forward our marriage was over.
I'm the Sean Parker of twerking. I invented the Napster of twerking.
What social network of twerking did you invent?
I have an idea for a hotline called Dial a Fuckface. No matter when you call or how many people call, it just goes to my cell.
What if your moneymaker is your cunning intellect and sense?
I gotta shake my moneymaker like somebody's about to pay me. We're dads, we're on Pinterest, and we want justice.
Oh, here's another day where I appreciate plant life. You! I love plants!
My dog is the Houdini of dogs. The Houdoggy.
How's this for tech savvy? I'm gonna cut your esophagus out of your throat!
I'm gonna use my iPhone to cut a hole in your stomach. There's a 16 gigabyte flash drive in your stomach.
Steve Miller was lying. He knew that he couldn't fly.
I don't know how people found the motivation to have kids before Instagram.
Let's see what God has to say about this.
Get off my DSL connection. These birds are creative, but can they paint?
When I get home, I'm taking out the trash and you're going with it because you're trash.
I gotta go get my All City tattoo touched up.
Holy shit, I'm online! Holy shit, this is the internet!
So tell me a little bit about how you put those collage-y videos together.
So I usually start by improvising humor for a really long time. Usually if there's a 2-minute video, that means I shot about 2 hours. And then I cut out all the parts that seemed like they flopped.
It looks like most of the time you're holding either your phone or a camera at arm's length.
yeah, it's all in the selfie position, you know? But I think that rawness and using like a populist form, theoretically anybody could make this type of video. But I really appreciate art that's like that. It's not trying to impress you with its formal components and like its craft. It's trying to actually just move you. I still do write some longer poems for the page, and the way that I do those is very similar to the way that I make the videos, though. I try to compile a lot of material, and then I cut out all the stuff but what seemed the most exciting, the most fresh.
Well, do you want to read us something from your latest book called If You Don't Love the Moon, You're a Word We Can't Say on Public Radio?
Hold on. Okay, so I'll just read it, I guess. Everybody I see hurting, and I don't want them to hurt. I want you to be okay. I don't know how to stop you from hurting, but I will try to do it. I wish I was better at it. I want to stand for what is right to me. I don't want to do anything that I think is bad for humans or other animals or anyone. I want to work harder than I have been. I want to be hugging you. I wish that I could take care of you somehow. I don't want you to be cold or alone. You are beautiful and deserve to feel good.
That's so lovely.
And thank you.
What we didn't mention is that the subtitle for that book is Poems and Selfies. So why did you put your face in this book of poetry?
I mean, partly it was just the amusement. Because selfies was such a funny, loaded term, I felt like it was amusing to put this, like, low art form next to poetry, which is traditionally this high art form. There's also something where Walt Whitman said, when I give myself. And I really loved Walt Whitman so much because he really gave you his whole person, like, everything that he feels is there in such a sincere form. And when people watch me on the internet, it's in video form with my face right there. And when people see my tweets and everything, it's got my little avatar right there with my face. And so I felt like being there in the book would be fun also.
A Gawker critic called your mashup videos selfies of the soul. When you're shooting them, do they feel like selfies to you?
I mean, the camera angle makes them selfie-like. I mean, maybe in a deep sense, you know, in a metaphorical sense, because it's so stream of consciousness, because it's so like tapping into a level where I don't know what I'm going to say before I say it. And then when I get onto the really sincere rants in some of my videos, which, you know, you played some of We're Alive at the Same Time, smiley face. And in that video, the part you played is mostly funny stuff. But at the end, it gets very sincere and very sort of ecstatic where I'm talking about we're alive at the same time. My videos, my poems, they're selfies of the soul in that I'm trying to put everything that I really love and believe in there.
You present so many different characters in your work. Maybe they're all aspects of yourself, or maybe they're just characters you riff on. How much time do you spend thinking about how the people who watch your videos perceive you or think of you?
Well, one of my favorite responses to my videos is when people say, like, what the hell did I just watch, you know? So in a sense, I'm okay with people judging me. A common thing is that people think I'm on drugs, which I'm not. I don't do any drugs. You know, if you pay attention to what I'm doing, then you can get who I am. When people misunderstand me, which is pretty frequent still, I think they're usually being pretty careless. I don't know. But maybe it's just a generational thing, or like how we sort of engage with culture. You know, there's this term post-irony. When people talk about that, they often think it means to be very calculated. But I feel like my work is, and most people who understand that term would say that my work is post-ironic, but it's not a calculated thing. Overall, to me, it's just playfulness.
The generational thing has come up a lot in the office over the past few weeks, and it seems, particularly around selfies, part of the reason there seems to be this generational divide about it is because people in their 30s or 40s or 50s are maybe more concerned about having one clear public persona, but that doesn't necessarily seem to be true for people in their teens and 20s.
Well, the thing that's happening in terms of public persona now is that all the different parts of your life are having a harder time keeping themselves separate, you know. Usually you were able to be somebody at your job and then come home and be somebody else to your family and somebody else at the family reunion and somebody else with your buddies or whatever. But now it's like you're using the same social networks to sort of show off yourself to all of them. So in a sense, you kind of have to be one person now more than ever.
And maybe the one self that we are now asked to present to the world gets to have more aspects to it.
Yes, I think definitely. And I think that's one of the best things about social media that's very exciting. You know, we're moving toward a world where employers and everybody is going to have to accept that people have a life outside of their job.
Well, can we go out on a poem? Maybe there's something else you want to read for us?
I have this thing that I wrote about what being a poet means to me. I could maybe read that. It's sort of a prose block.
Sounds great.
For a long time, I was not passionate about the label poet. I would point to strict definitions of poetry and say the label was really meaningless. There's no hard boundary of what you can call poetry versus what you can't. Every barrier has been destroyed. If you study much of 20th century avant-garde lit, you'll know that you can literally call anything poetry based on the precedents that exist now. So I decided that it makes more sense to think about it emotionally. What connotations does poetry have, and do I want to invoke those? There are some poor connotations relating to academia, maybe, but for the most part, I do like the connotations around poetry and even more around poet. 6 years ago, when I told my uncle I was a poet, he said, "Tell me something wise about life," or something. It seemed funny to me at the time, but now I'm thinking, actually, yes, I want that to be the public perception of my occupation. I will tell you wise things about life. Or I will try, anyway. I will strive to be the dreamer, the poet, and the idealist that most people are too busy or too business-oriented to be most of the time. My role is to remind people of carpe diem, of love, of nature, and to say it in a way that is memorable so it sticks with you. That's a need that goes back through the millennia and will continue as long as humans live. This is a deep tradition I get to be a part of. I am a poet.
That's Steve Rogenbuck with producer Sarah Nix. You can hear their extended conversation on our website at ttbook.org. Of course, as many people point out, selfies aren't really new. Artists have been making self-portraits of one kind or another for centuries, and not just because painting or drawing yourself is easier and cheaper than finding a model. Art historian James Hall has a new book out called The Self-Portrait: Cultural History. He told me that long before there were cell phones or oil paint, there were self-portraits.
I go right back to ancient Egypt, where there's a portrait of a court sculptor, and we see him with a pot belly, which is the attribute of the prosperous rich.
So would he have been proud of that big pot belly?
Yes, he would. He would have been very proud of it.
So I was surprised to read in your book that the tradition of self-portraits seems to begin to take off during the Middle Ages. There's one that shows a guy, 12th century monk, Hildebertus. It's kind of a simple sort of line drawing. It looks like he's working. He's working on illuminating a manuscript. Over on a table, there's a mouse, and looks like he's going to throw a stone or something at the mouse.
Yes, he's throwing a sponge at the mouse, and there's a caption in the book which says, "Damn you, mouse, for causing me so much trouble." And it seems as though, on the face of it, it's just an amusing joke. But Hildebertus is saying, by noticing the mouse, I am, you know, enlarging my consciousness. Mm. And by painting myself and being self-conscious, I'm showing another aspect of God's creation.
Well, things really start to change, and we start to see what I think of as more traditional self-portraits in the Renaissance, where you have, you know, a canvas and there's the artist, him or herself, mostly himself, looking out at you. By the end of the Renaissance, when Rembrandt begins painting, self-portraits have become much more common. Could you tell us a little bit about the context in which Rembrandt painted one of his early self-portraits? It's the one where he's wearing a plumed beret from 1629.
Yes, well, Rembrandt is extraordinary. I suppose our basic idea about Rembrandt doesn't go that much further than that, the New Yorker cartoon, which has Rembrandt in his studio, and the caption is, Hendrika, I feel another self-portrait coming on. Bring in the funny hats. as though he just sort of made them on a whim. But most of his self-portraits, almost a third of them, were made in about the first 3 years of his professional life, and a lot of them were engravings which could be mass produced. And in a way it appears as though he was trying to imply that he was famous before he actually was famous. And this, the painting you mention, is a fantastic example of this, because here's the young artist, but yet he's wearing the headgear of a courtier.
You know, the person who immediately springs to mind, my mind at least, when we talk about telling a life story through paintings is Frida Kahlo, the great Mexican painter. She did dozens of self-portraits.
Yeah, she's a very much a 20th century phenomenon, the career self-portraitist.
She painted herself over and over and over again, but in many different situations, many different costumes. And of course, you know, she was physically in pain so much of her life from a very early accident. What do you think she's doing with those self-portraits? Was it, I don't know, self-portraiture as a kind of self-analysis or wanting to control how people saw her?
Well, she initially trained as a doctor, and I tend to think that in the self-portraits, she's both doctor and patient. She's trying to show the suffering she's experienced, but at the same time, she's trying to suggest that she can control it. And the painting, The Two Fridas, is a good example of that. Two identical Frida Kahlos are sitting on a bench next to each other, one wearing European costume and the other one wearing Mexican costume. There's almost an anatomical illustration of the heart in each figure. So the heart is exposed. And she was getting divorced from Diego Rivera, the painter. So she's showing the suffering she's going through. And one of the figures is holding a vein that's been cut, but she's also holding forceps to close the vein. So in this, she's almost literally is doctor and patient.
Mm. So we've been spending this hour talking about the selfie phenomenon that's really swept across the globe over the last few years. Do you think, is there a place for selfies in the conversation about self-portraits?
Yes, I think there has to be. The first artist I know, or well-known artist I know of who made a selfie was Edvard Munch when he was in a sanatorium at the time, and he held a camera out at arm's length and photographed himself. That was in the 1930s. And of course, then there is Andy Warhol's photo booth and Polaroid.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what I'm curious about is most people who are taking selfies are not thinking of themselves as artists making a self-portrait. But is there a way in which you would suggest, as an art historian, are there ways you could deepen the experience?
Well, yes. I suppose my feeling about self-portraits is that the ones where artists eyeball the viewer are the least interesting ones. It's like someone who's telling you something that's of enormous importance, but of course it's only of enormous importance to them. And I think the best self-portraits, they're withholding something. Trying to be too intense is perhaps not a good idea in a self-portrait in 2014.
James Hall's new book is called The Self-Portrait, A Cultural History. That's it for our look at selfies, but you can have the last word. Just go to our website to leave your thoughts. That's at ttbook.org. Better yet, send us your selfie. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
You are about to experience a totally new dimension in
ideas. The intellectual thrill ride of the year. To the best of our knowledge, proudly presents
Dangerous
Ideas.
I'm Nils Christie from University of Oslo. I'm supposed to talk about dangerous ideas, but I think these ideas I have are rather natural and in reality will decrease the violence level of society. First of all, it's important to treat people as people, not as animals. To imprison people, well, we do it mostly to be unpleasant towards them. We then expect they should learn, they should come out as better people. Of course, they're mostly more dangerous, less able to live in society. Therefore, I think it is very important, for a welfare state at least, to keep the prison population at the lowest possible level. We have some 73 prisoners per 100,000. You have 730-something in your system. It is abnormally high, and it would be a great humanitarian mission and make United States a more safe place if you reduced it. There are so small things they are placed in prison for. A drug is a typical one. Small quanta of drugs consumed, or you have it in your pocket and off you go to prison. It would be much better to give them a warning, have some agreement that they should change some patterns in life, and invest in helping them to an ordinary social lifestyle. To have people in prison costs the state a lot of money. Those monies ought to be used more directly to help people who are socially handicapped. Because we know, in your country as in mine, those in prison are mostly the most socially disadvantaged of the population. It's of greater importance to solve their social problems instead of adding the burden of suffering on them. Another matter here, and that is the importance of seeing the other persons, those sentenced, seeing them as ordinary human beings, and for the prisoners to see their surroundings as ordinary human beings. Most people are nice people. It's so important to build down the barriers. People are not monsters. They might have done something idiotic, but they don't go around doing that all the time. It's important to create social situations where it is possible to see them as fellow beings.
That's Norwegian criminologist Nils Christie's dangerous idea. For more notions to shake up your thinking, check out our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, journalist Dan Fagan. He just won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Tom's River. It's a true story, a remarkable tale of industrial pollution and its health impacts for people in a small New Jersey town. Fagan told Steve Paulson why it's hard to prove the long-term health effects of environmental toxins.
For a long time, not much happened in Tom's River, and then the chemical industry came to town in the early 1950s in the form of a huge factory that was, at the time, one of the largest dye manufacturing facilities in the world.
And this factory was actually dumping chemicals right into the local river.
They were. I mean, the nature of dye manufacturing, especially then, is that you actually generate a lot more liquid waste than actual dye. There was solid waste that would go into sort of open pits all over this property, almost two square miles. There was air pollution that would go up the smokestacks. But the biggest pollution problem of all was this liquid waste, and just in tremendous, tremendous volumes. One of the reasons that SIBA, the Swiss company that controlled Tom's River Chemical, picked the site to begin with was that the soil was sandy. That was a wonderfully efficient way to get rid of liquid waste, is just to dump it.
Was this all legal then?
The context, the legal context is, depending on how you interpreted the laws, it was probably mostly legal. But later, on into the 80s and 90s, it was not. There were a series of legal conflicts with the regulators. Meanwhile, there was a whole other thing happening too, Steve, which is there were a lot of illegal dump sites. People would take waste down from Newark and Jersey City and places like that and just dump it in the middle of the forest. And there was a guy, a really disreputable guy, who told Union Carbide, don't worry, I'll take this waste off your hands. And he just dumped it in the back 2 acres of a chicken farm. And that became a second horrendous Superfund site in addition to the SIBA site. Hmm. So to finally get around to the health implications, starting in the 1980s, people started to say, gee, I think we have a problem here in Toms River. There was a woman named Linda Gillick who her son was diagnosed with a neuroblastoma when he was just a few months old.
What are the symptoms of that?
It's a cancer of the central nervous system. At the time, Michael's chances of survival were very poor, so much so that the Gillicks even bought a casket for Michael because when the time came, they didn't want to have to buy a casket. But Michael defied the odds. He's still alive today. He's in his mid-30s now.
Wow.
And Linda started looking around and, you know, every time she would go to a hospital in Philadelphia or New York and to get the advanced cancer treatment, every time she would go, she would meet other people from Toms River. She said, something is going on here. Something's going on here.
And it's worth pointing out, I mean, she's not a doctor or a scientist or
all.
A health professional. She's
not
a mother.
All.
And
not
she just
all.
Sort of took this upon
she's
herself
a grade school teacher.
To do this.
Yeah, she's a grade school teacher. And I should say it wasn't just her. Other people were looking around and sort of saying, gee, this doesn't seem right. One of the most influential people, as it turned out, to notice this was a nurse at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia named Lisa Bornazian. You know, they would have sort of black humor on the pediatrics ward. Oh, another kid from Toms River. And she would say to the physicians, what's going on here? And the physicians would say, oh, it's nothing. You're just a nurse. Do your job, you know. And it turned out that Lisa had a sister-in-law who worked for the EPA. Her sister-in-law finally got the ball rolling. And an investigation began in the mid-1990s.
Hmm. The way you've told the story, it would seem like, oh, it's sort of an open and shut case, you know,
uh-huh.
Chemicals being dumped into the water there, massive amounts, and all of these childhood cancers popping up in this town of Toms River. But it's
right.
Not so simple. In fact, it's incredibly difficult to prove the cause and effect here.
It is. It's very difficult. For the core area of Toms River, it was multiple three or four times what's expected. The thing is, though, Steve, that because childhood cancer is relatively rare, there's going to be a lot of natural fluctuation. You know, nothing in nature is evenly distributed. It's sort of like if you were conducting a poll to see who was going to be president, but you only talked to five or six people. You would get a result, but you don't know whether those numbers are reliable or not. They would have a very large margin of error. And, well, that's true for epidemiology, too. That
So how do scientists actually prove that there is a cancer cluster that's
right.
more than just random cases that happen to sort of be in this one area?
Right. And it's sort of a whole cascade of tests that you do. One of the most important things that you look for is what's called the dose response. So if you think that you have an environmentally induced cancer cluster, you ought to see a pattern where the higher the exposures were, the greater the number of cases should be. Sure enough, they found that in Toms River. And the other thing they did in Toms River that was really quite interesting was they constructed very elaborate computer models of both the air pollution and water pollution to try to figure out which parts of town were highest exposed and which were not. And then they took those exposures and tried to match them up with the cases. And again, they found very strong associations. Hmm. So now you use the word proof. An epidemiologist would never use the word proof. It's about strength of association. And ultimately, to everyone's shock, they found that there was indeed statistically significant pattern of associations.
So what was the upshot of all of this? There were lawsuits and a settlement, right?
Yeah, there was never actually a lawsuit per se. I mean, some of your listeners would be familiar with the book and the movie Civil Action, and John Travolta played the attorney Jan Schlickman, and Jan was involved in this case too. And if you remember the Civil Action story, you know that Jan literally lost his shirt. He lost everything he owned on that case, and
because it's so costly to try to
incredibly
prove a case
costly,
like this.
And also he was somewhat reckless in the way that he approached the case. So he wanted to learn from that mistake, and he wanted to try to find a negotiated settlement that would be short of the sort of slash-and-burn courtroom warfare that he practiced and lost in Woburn, Massachusetts.
To basically get what you can. I mean, you have to compromise here.
You have to compromise, and that was a hard thing for the families involved. They wound up with financial settlements that, you know, ranged somewhere around $100,000 for the lowest settlements to around $500,000 or $600,000 for the higher settlements. You know, to me, is that adequate compensation for what they went through? I don't think so. But it was what they could achieve. The plant closed down. The dye manufacturing and plastics manufacturing moved first to Alabama and now to China. So, you know, we've sort of outsourced our environmental problems to some extent. We're happy to get those blue jeans made in China. And to some extent, we're subsidizing the same kind of environmental practices over there.
Although, so you're saying probably the same kind of dumping is happening now in a place like China.
In China, the phenomenon is often called cancer villages because the Chinese cities are so vast and sprawling that you couldn't identify a cluster even if you tried. But in the village, people actually know their neighbors, and so it is possible to try to map potentially environmentally induced illnesses. So that's happening in China right now.
Now, you have a very sobering comment in your book. You say that the chief legacy of this story is to solidify governmental opposition to conducting more investigations like the one in Toms River. In other words, it was so time-consuming, so draining that maybe government investigators just don't want to do this again. It's just, you know, too much work, too difficult.
Yeah. These things are very expensive. They are, as you said, draining, emotionally draining, and they're also very politically damaging for the politicians involved. You get the big companies angry at you. You get the voters angry at you because they want clearer answers than you're able to give them. But my own view is that we need way more epidemiology, not less. Toms River is a much safer place now. What I was trying to say with that sentence, government officials feel this way, but they're wrong. They're acting based on their own short-sighted motivations, not what's in the long-term best interests of public health.
Dan Fagan just won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Toms River. Steve Paulson talked with him. And that's what's on our minds today. We post new On Our Minds segments every day. You can check them out at ttbook.org or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. The handle's ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Sarah Nix produced today's show with help from Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, Stephanie Youngblood, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.